Welcome to The Art of Growth. I'm Joel Hubbard.
And I'm Jim Zartman. And today we are talking to a panel of type ones. And type ones are oriented in the body triad. So we're returning to the body triad today with the type one.
Yeah. Body people tend to move more than they do anything else. It's about motion. Or if they're not in motion, at least their thoughts are around that. It's around action. Am I doing the right things? Am I frozen because I can't do the right things and I'm not sure of what I'm supposed to do? So action or inaction, but it's still very focused on that thing. Whether I am in motion or I'm not in motion, I'm focused on that reality.
Even the emotions are around what should I do?
What should I do about it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Just so we're positioning, the body triad is what we refer to as the 8, the 9, and the 1. So last week's episode with the type 5, they're oriented in the head triad, which is the 5, the 6, and the 7. And the heart triad is the 2, the 3, and the 4. So the 1, how is it that they relate to action?
They do so from very much a moral standpoint. Like there's a moral certitude. This is what is the right thing to do, and that is what I need to do. So there's an internal discernment that's also trying to be matched against the external feedback of the world. So ones do very much – are very aware of what they believe to be right and wrong, but they also need to have that sense of, is the world or authority figures, are they behind that? Are they supporting that? Do I feel supported in what I'm believing or arguing for or moving towards? And that is what drives a lot of the one. So discern what is right, wrong, and then get into action, you know, make things better. So perfection is a big deal for them. Their attention tends towards what is not working right, what's imperfect, and then go about make it better. Even if it's doing something physically to improve something, it is driven by this higher ideal, which is, this is what actually is right, and this is what should be done. This is how things are to function in this world. And so along with it comes this very heavy weight of criticism, internal criticism. Did I do enough? Did I do the right thing? Was it perfect enough? That's a heavy weight to carry. But it also, on the high side, is also something that helps them to make things really good and do a very good job at improving themselves and improving the world around them.
Yeah. And we've said for type ones that this key word is grace. And so we want to start with that point. We want that to be the feel that was in the room when we're asking them questions, because we want them to be themselves. And like we said, we didn't do any kind of coaching, or we're not pointing at growth paths while we're in the middle of these conversations on relationships, because we want it to be about letting the type speak, full acceptance, because acceptance and grace comes before transformation, even for those who are focused on wanting to do the right thing. So we're going to get into the panel of ones, but before we do that, we want to remind you that you can get in contact with us if you're interested in coaching or would like to keep up with us on email or whatever. You can do that at www.theartofgrowth.org, and you can get into contact with Joel for coaching there, or with me for relationship coaching with me and my wife, Abby. But right now we're going to get into our panel of type ones talking about relationships.
Well, we want to welcome the type one panel. I'm so happy you guys are here with me. I am here with Beth, Greg, Amanda, Stephanie, and the youngest of our one panel, who is only 5 weeks old, and that's Amanda's little one named Jules. And we're so happy to have all you guys here today. Let's start with just maybe a brief introduction to who you guys are. Tell us a little bit about yourselves.
My name is Beth, 30 years old. I'm a 911 dispatcher. I'm a type one with a two wing.
My name is Greg. I am full-time vocational minister. Work with refugees and immigrants and leaders from all over the world that are here in the greater Boston area. Have 3 children, been married 36 years.
Wow.
And currently have 2 Chinese students living with us this year.
Wow, very cool.
Yeah. I'm Amanda. I am a nurse midwife as my career. I've been married 7 years, and I have 2 kids, a 5-year-old and, as Joel said, 5-week-old. I am the middle child of 3. My parents have been married for 40-some years. That's good.
I'm Stephanie. I'm 27 years old. I'm a physical therapist. I've been married for 4 years. My husband's a nurse, and we do traveling healthcare together. So I'm actually from Houston, Texas, living in Vermont right now, and I usually change states every 3 months. So it's a fun life. But yeah, I'm a 1 with a 2 wing.
See, that would just be really interesting to explore what it is like for a type 1 to have to move every 3 months.
It's uncomfortable.
I don't think I can imagine.
I can imagine. Well, so the type 1s in the literature are described as being perfectionists and also as reformers. The challenge of the perfectionism, but also the wonderful high side as a reformer. But it means that your attention does tend towards things like right and wrong, good and bad thinking. And ones often report having this really strong inner critic that functions almost like another person inside them, kind of regularly corrects them or points out the mistakes they have made or things that are imperfect around them, how things should be. And so I'd like you guys to maybe just talk about yourselves more. I don't want to say more than that about the type ones because you guys are here and I get to hear from you. So maybe talk about how you first found out you were a one, what that did to you, how you responded to that, and anything else you want to say about type ones.
Well, you told me I was a type one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And things just made a lot more sense to me. I think I was like, wow.
Yeah, because at first you thought maybe type 5?
5, yeah. Yeah. So according to the test I took online, I was a 5. I actually took 3 tests online, and I got like 3 different answers.
And once you saw the motivation of the 1, is that what sort of started to click for you, the behavior, the motivation,
yeah, the behavior, the constantly need to have things like go a certain way, the control part mainly. Things always need to be like perfect. You know, I have a hard time when things are not perfect. And then the emotional part, too. The, you know, don't like to show emotion, stuff like that. That was another thing that was like, oh, wow, that kind of makes a lot more sense now.
Hmm.
I remember during our interview, I had looked up the Enneagram prior and kind of looked up all the different types. And I was kind of leaning towards like, I think I'm a 1. But, you know, it's kind of hard to tell when you're just reading all the types. And I don't remember exactly what you asked during our interview, but it was something about justice and something about right and wrong. And in my mind, I was like, yes, things need to be right. And and it just clicked. I was like, yeah, that is what motivates me. Things need to be right. Need to be done right the first time. And it really kind of revolutionized my life describing the inner critic. Because I always knew, I mean, in my mind, I'm always criticizing myself. But I thought everybody did that. And I thought it was just, just a thing. Like, but knowing that that's kind of particular to my type, it's easier to address it now. So that's nice.
You kind of don't feel so alone.
Right. It's only, you don't feel quite so crazy.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Yeah, the way you said this perfect thing, I was laughing at myself when I, to prepare for this, I was reviewing the description online that you sent me, Joel, about what the one is. And down at the bottom, it says something like, you know, in Genesis, when God created the world, he ended each day by saying, and it was good. And the ones say, yeah, but. My first thought was, yeah, but when I was like growing up, my parents were always telling me it doesn't have to be perfect. Like, you're too much of an idealist. You can just do like what's required of you with schoolwork, with whatever. Yeah. And the passage that I would always bring up to them was in Matthew, where Jesus says, be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. And so for the description to be like, but everything's good, I was like, but that's not the one you're supposed to be following. It's this other one that says to be perfect. So that's the voice in my head. Yeah.
For me, I think I was leaning toward the 3 initially, the performer, because I am self-aware of like wanting to do a good job and wanting to please others and to succeed in what I do. But the more I reflected on it, I really came to realize like it's 10 times or 100 times more internal to me than external of what other people think. And so it really resonated with me, the notion of being like the inner critic or the harsh critic, or walking into a room or to a new environment and looking around and just reflecting on what could be different. I mean, because I'm in ministry and I visit around to a lot of churches, I'm going into different churches and I'm kind of looking the same, you know. It just takes me a long time because I'm sizing up what's going on and how this is going. And it's very hard for me to kind of be present because I'm kind of evaluating things constantly. But the greatest thing I'm evaluating is my own self and my own, you know, performance. And I can even do good and others can even tell me I have done good. But still internally, I have a very harsh, harsh analysis of myself.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is it's funny how when you said, Amanda, you said that verse, be perfect. That's just so very telling of a one. That's where your attention went. Like there's any other verse could have caught your attention, but that's the one, right? That's remarkable. Yeah. And the your description, Greg, of even that whole thing of the tension between external affirmation and that internal, you know, knowing of whether you did well or didn't do well. I mean, this seems to me for other ones, that's fairly a constant thing. The need for public approval, the public affirmation or people saying you did a good job, but yet there's this internal sense of like, yeah, but I know, you know. So you hold yourselves to a pretty high standard. Yeah. Well, let's begin with some questions about relationships because this is what we're doing tonight. So let's start off with what do you bring to relationships as a type one? What do you think you bring?
Well, I'm married to a seven, so I feel like it's a wonderful adventure.
Yes. So
some of this is biased to that relationship, but I feel like I bring some stability and structure to the relationship, the ability and the mindset to carry things through. Like if there's a goal or if we're trying to work towards something other than just kind of flimsily putting out like, oh, this is where we want to be, I can be like, okay, but here's how we get to it the right way. Here's how we get to it effectively. And yeah, so.
Mm.
The first thing that came to my mind with that question was that I really care. Like I care what's happening with the relationship. I care what's happening with the other person. And I think maybe because of that, there's not a whole lot of relationships that are getting that attention from me. Like I have like a small inner circle really of people who I'm working on relationships actively with. But if I'm doing it, I'm like all in.
Mm.
And so to whatever commitment we've made to each other, to whatever the needs are between us at that time, I really care about how it's going. Doesn't mean it's always going well. It's probably my fault if it's not going well.
But then you'll fix it.
At least in my head.
But then you can fix it yourself.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That was the first thing that came to mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think for me, like I value authenticity and transparency. So my best relationships are those that I can be self-disclosing of my good, bad, and ugly, but that others are also willing to do that. I will kind of sniff out if people are not being authentic. And I think going along with that, like people who listen well, I really value people who listen well, and I hope to be a good listener. And if people don't listen well, those tend to be kind of shallow relationships for me, and I don't tend to invest a lot in those relationships unless it's just purely for ministry because I need to care for this person. But I don't really I wouldn't view that as a strong relationship for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm seeing some head nodding.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. It's a big deal to have authentic relationships. And kind of like Greg said, it's really easy for me to sniff those out if I know that someone's just kind of not all in or being fake or not listening. It's not easy to keep those around.
And it kind of goes with the trust thing as well.
Yeah.
Because if they're not being authentic, how can you trust them?
Right.
So listening is a big deal. I mean, you guys mentioned that. Being listened to. When you said you're all in, I mean, you said, you know, when I'm into a relationship, I'm all in. Like it's there. You guys feel the same way? Like it's you really pour a lot of energy into those relationships.
For me, it takes a while to get to that point. Uh-huh. But once I get to that point, I'm 110% in.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. It might take me 6 months, a year to get there.
Okay. Anything else you want to say? What else do you bring to relationships?
Understanding.
Loyalty.
Encouragement.
Connecting deeply if the other person's willing.
Mm-hmm. What does that look like? Say more about that.
I think of it like first with my wife. I love having our Sabbath day together because it's a day that we can go have coffee and we can sit and chat. We can read something together. We can listen and interact about something, but really more kind of sharing what's going on in our worlds. That's like really, really important to me. And I think somebody else said like I like order. And so order and rhythm is like really, really important to me. I went to a monastery like about 2 weeks ago and spent 4 days there, and I absolutely loved it, like the order of it and things and stuff like that. But people who aren't wired like that, they don't maybe feel that need as much. And so it's always this negotiation, like with my relationships, like with my wife, of what connecting means and looks like for her and what my expectations are. So I put a lot in that, particularly on my day off, my sabbatical day. Like I have a lot of expectations. Like I want to connect with her on that day.
Mm.
And if I don't, where she's a little more spontaneous and like flexible and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So it's always navigating that. And so what the connection looks
yours
like.
Yours is scheduled.
Yeah. I value the the scheduled time. This, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So on that vein, when you were speaking, I thought, yes, expectations are something else I bring to a relationship. Like, I expect to be listened to. I expect that you'll be home when you say you will, which, if you know my husband, you know does not always happen. So growing as a person for me has required understanding that, like, what I expect is not always clear to everyone unless I say it. I had a therapist who told me that an unspoken expectation is a planned resentment. And I think that sort of sums it up, like to learn to that my values and my expectations of what is right or wrong in a relationship or in anything aren't always already in the heads of the people around me. And relationships can deteriorate if you just harbor all these resentments about expectations that aren't being met. So being aware that I'm bringing those expectations to relationships is helpful, I guess, if you respond to it. Not always a good thing I'm bringing into a relationship, but I'm bringing it.
So some clarity.
Mm-hmm.
You bring a bit of clarity to relationships where some things might be not communicated. I mean, part of it that you described as needing to communicate is some of those expectations. But do you feel like you bring clarity at least? These are things that the way things should be and the way systems should run, you bring that level of clarity too. Would you say that that's true? How your
on
family should be? And
Yeah. I at least have a clear vision. I don't know if it's necessarily actually the right one all the time,
mm-hmm.
but I do bring a sense that I have clarity. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are some good things you bring? You think you're like, you know, here's, you know, you bring order. That's a good thing. Clarity at your best, you bring clarity. Loyalty, you guys are loyal people, right? So what else do you think you bring that's maybe something good to relationships?
I bring patience. I tend to give people the benefit of the doubt, I guess is an easier way to say it.
Okay.
I think in the expectations, like one of it is an expectation of myself that I'll be loving in this perfect way. And I think generally that's serving the relationship that I want to meet you where your needs are, you know, if you're somebody who I care about and who I've committed to. And even if, like you were saying with people you're ministering, like you'll serve them in that way. And I think probably we also bring it to those relationships, even if it's not somebody who it's like your partner or your family, like my patients, I will try to be all with them when I'm with them to meet their needs. And I think that feels like it goes along with all of what we're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about doing a really good job at what you do?
I think that's kind of what I'm trying to say.
That's what it sounds like. Yeah. That's what you're going. Is everything you do really well. And that's your intention. Even if you see the flaw in things that you do, the intention and generally the product of what you're providing in relationships and work is really good.
Yeah, I tend to, with my patients, I'll put 100% effort into their wellness. And to the point, I mean, it can, it, I mean, it's almost like, I mean, like their goal is like almost my goal. I'm like, no, I'm with this, I'm in this with you, and we're gonna get there together. So
it's not a whole lot of cutting corners.
I don't have that option on my job.
Not in your office.
I think for me, it's like I always have this ideal that I'm always reaching for in pretty much everything, in my relationships, my work, or whatever. And there's a whole theological grid to that, too. It's like I view life like a rubber band, like an elastic, like aspiring to our high calling. And so, like, I view that everything in life, my relationships, my work, they're like there's this high calling, this elastic that's like trying to pull you up. Again, it's good because it causes you to try to excel in what you're doing, your relationships, your work, and those kinds of things. The other thing, though, is it can be oppressive because you never measure up to it, you know, and you're always kind of striving. So
there's always that need that you have to or you could have done better. Yeah.
What do you need from your relationships? You started to talk about that a little bit. Like, Greg, you talked about connection. And but let's hear more about that. Like, what are your needs from the people that you're close to or people that you work with?
So for me, I need someone that's going to make me laugh because I have way too much going on in my head. and then, like, when things don't make sense to me, I tend to go off on, like, rant or tangents until it makes sense, you know. And so I need someone just to shut up and listen until I work it out and then talk about it. So instead of sitting there and saying, well, it makes sense because this – no, because – the way you're explaining is not how it's going to make sense in my mind. You know, so someone just to like sit back and just nod their head and listen until it clicks in my head. You know,
I need to be understood. A lot of times I have like a reason or a good intention for doing something that I do. And I don't even always verbalize that that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. But I need the people who are close to me, at least, to know that the reason my actions are the way they are is because I think it's going to lead to something good. You know, one of my pet peeves is when you do something on accident or misspeak or something, and everybody's like, oh, yeah, you really meant to say that. I was like, no, you don't know what I meant to do. Like, it's really important that you know my intentions. And you
ooh,
know?
I felt a little bit of energy there. That's good.
So that's really important to me.
I like it. I felt the energy there. That's awesome. there's some agreement here in this room.
Yeah. No, I could just think through like a number of disagreements I've had in my life in the last year where that was exactly what was going on. That's why I just, yes, like to be understood, to be heard out, even when like I'm not quite getting it fast, because sometimes figuring out why I did what I did is not always very clear, or why I think it should be the way it should be is not always very clear. Somebody who will take the time to sometimes give me space to figure that out and sometimes listen even when they don't believe that that could possibly be why I did what I did. So to reach toward understanding.
That's usually what sets me off on my little tangent.
all these things are kind of resonating with me. You know, somebody that listens well, somebody that asks good questions, somebody that's patient, because I'm a slow processor. And so if you want somebody like this is going to respond really, really quick to things, I'm a very slow processor, so I'm thinking about it. And so I need people that are going to be patient and not frustrated because I'm not a quick responder.
Yeah, it can be really tricky. Like, there's a few people in my life who – my sister is one that really comes to mind. Like, when if we have any kind of conflict between us, she just wants to like fix it right then. And I don't know what I don't. She's not been typed. I don't know what she is in the Enneagram, but like immediately she's ready to talk about it. She wants to process. She wants to make it okay. And I'm like, no, I am still boiling inside. And I don't even know why yet. So we have to separate for like sometimes a number of hours before I can talk about it. It's very frustrating for her.
Mm.
And so I guess that's probably why a tool like this can be so helpful, because you can understand each other's needs. But
yeah,
the slow processing is familiar to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's really good. I mean, I'm learning a lot just listening to you talk about this. It's really very helpful to me listening to you talk about this. As you're talking, I'm getting like all these questions, more questions. Like, this is interesting. Like, it really reveals the process that's going on.
Even the process, like one of the things at the monastery when I went, the way that they do their liturgy and stuff is like really slow. Like they read and they pause and they have pause marks in their reading, like an asterisk to say this is a time to pause. And like that cadence, even in the reading, to stop and think, like really resonates with me. It's like it's the way I'm wired.
That is really like I love that, because it's so helpful for me to understand. You know, as a person who processes at a high rate of speed, I find those pauses really, really stressful and anxiety causing. And so, if things aren't moving at a rapid pace, the faster I drive, the calmer I get. And the lower my blood pressure goes. It's when I'm driving slow that everything starts to rise for me. So there's that whole opposite effect. So it's fascinating to see what's happening in the type one when you're seeking for more of that. Let me process. Let me figure this out, because it's a complex system. And there's also a need to get it right, that, you know, and really understand yourself well and not rush that process to make a mistake in trying to figure that out. I'd love to hear an example, because a lot of this is maybe might be helpful to our audience to understand. What is it? Maybe an example in a relationship. You two had mentioned stuff about, you know, what happens in a relationship.
So I need time to process.
should we schedule this at a different time?
Yeah, I have to think.
Part two.
I'm
this.
Sure I can think of one with my sister. If somebody else wants to talk first, I'm sure I can.
Well, I have many examples with me and my husband. When we were first married, we would go to church together, and the church we went to in Texas had a pastor who was very in depth with his sermons. Just a lot of material in a short amount of time. It's kind of a classic Texas Baptist preacher, really. But right after this happened for a good 6 months during our marriage. Every single Sunday, get in the car right after sermon. Randy's like, hey, so what do you think? I have all these thoughts. And Jesus starts spouting them out. And I'm just like, I'm not hearing any of these, because and then he's like, well, what do you think? Like, wasn't this point great? Or wasn't what he said here, wasn't that convicting? And I was like, I don't know, because I couldn't even verbalize. I was like, because he was like, well, were you not listening, not in a judgmental way, but he's like, well, you know, we all have those days. And I was like, no, I was listening, but I just don't know yet. Like, I need time to think about what I thought of those words. And I don't want to say something that later I'm like, well, actually, I didn't mean that. So it took a good year in our relationship to kind of figure that out for him to slow down, but, you know, to kind of wait for me to process. And then for me to realize, you know, he's not meaning to bombard me. He's just very excited. So,
yeah. I mean, that's growth. That's really good. But that is a good description of what happens when you're being bombarded by another type that processes fast and wants that. So, but I want to get at the sort of the type behind that. When you're thinking about what you're thinking about, like, what am I thinking about? How did that impact me? Somebody might say, well, just put it out there. Who cares? If you change your mind later on, it's not a big deal. It's if you made a mistake, it's not a big deal. You can have a redo.
It is a big deal.
I love that expression and reaction right away. Yes, this is awesome. So talk to me, ones. So making a mistake like that is not acceptable. You really need to think through. Is that right? Is that what's maybe say more about that.
It's a whole process. You know, you can't just jump into it. Like, for me, I have to make a list or even if it's in my mind, I have to make a list of, okay, this is what was said, and then this is how I feel about it.
The example that came to mind when I was thinking was like a conflict with my sister, where something had happened that set me off. And we were on vacation. We'd been on vacation for like a week. I don't even remember what it was that set me off, so that is typical for me. But like where she put her toothbrush or something. And in the moment, she just wanted to be like, well, where should I put my toothbrush? But when I had time to stop and think about it, it was really like all week there'd been little like micro things that I had let kind of go because I thought that individual thing was not sufficient to merit a whole discussion.
Mm.
But they all added up to, in that moment, I exploded on her about the toothbrush or whatever it was. And I needed the time to reflect and be like, okay, in all of these circumstances, she was doing this little thing that bothered me because of this. So I don't know. I needed the time to be able to explain it because otherwise we're discussing a toothbrush for 2 hours and it's just stupid. Like, that's not even what's going on.
Yeah.
And so I feel like with a sermon, it would be similar for me. Like, I would hear in the moment, I might be like, yeah, the way he said that thing. But the truth is there was something else. Maybe that is that.
Yeah,
resonate?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's even more. I love this. I'm getting deeper. I feel like I'm going into the rabbit hole here with you guys. So there's even in the processing of something that happened 5 days ago, there's a delayed processing. There's a this happened, but I set it aside. Nearly everybody avoids dealing with things. I mean, certain types don't, but a lot of types do. They avoid dealing with something right away. But ones are described as those who can have a fight or can have a problem with their spouse, say if they're married, and they won't express the anger or the emotion in the context of that situation. Instead, what happens is it gets exercised in a different way. It comes out on the road at some driver who cuts them off, and that's where it shows up. It is, and that's all part of the one sort of trying to be good, right? This is what it means to be good. You don't yell, you don't get angry, you kind of repress that. So I'm hearing that in some of this. Is that true?
For me, it definitely
yes.
is. Yeah. I think it's, for me at least, it's hard to know, and maybe there's more work I need to do here. It's hard to know what the explanation is for why in all those other moments, I don't feel like it's okay to express the smaller need or the smaller whatever the case may be. I've tried to explore this before and I don't have an answer. If somebody else does, maybe I'll learn from it.
Sometimes I feel like with all the small things that like lead up to the big outbursts, a lot of times I used to not realize even those small things. They just kind of go in and just like a hide, hide, hide. But now I'm starting to realize them. And a lot of times I'm just like, it's hard to explain, but like, it feels like, no, it isn't. That's not something I should be angry about. Like, that's not, like, that's silly or that's not right. Or if someone made me angry, well, they're having a bad day. I should give them grace for that. But the problem is, like, I don't give them grace for it. And then it just all, like, stacks up and eventually just comes out.
Well, that's what it is. Kind of you stuff it down and just all boils over at one point.
Yeah.
It could be something as simple as you drop your phone.
Yeah.
Or someone asking, how was your day?
Yeah, there's something in there that's like, that shouldn't bother you.
It's not right that it bothers
like,
me or something.
That's a flaw in me that I'm even bothered by this little thing.
Mm. Yes.
So I'm not going to express that because somehow that makes it not bother me, but that's not how it works. So then the little bothers add up to what feel like a big bother.
Mm.
And for me, that's where, like, it feels like it's on the drop of a hat, it goes to rage.
Yes.
Mm.
And, like, it gets addressed a lot, like, with my son, my 5-year-old, not yet the 5-week-old. But, like, I could be having a bad day for 100 reasons, and I've let them all go because I'm trying to be nice. But then he does something little, and I can be very mean, and I hate that. And so then I feel even worse afterward because now I'm, like, also a bad mom on top of everything else.
Yeah.
So I think it's – I have something about that, like not feeling like I should be having the response I actually am having, so refusing to express it. until, like, there's just, you can't help it anymore once there's enough pressure built up, I guess.
Well, and then at the point when the pressure's built up so much, it's like, for me, I'm not even in control of what I say.
Totally.
It just...
So it comes right out. It's like
it just comes right, word vomit. It just, like
the
slow processing is gone at that point.
Exactly.
There's no processing.
Exactly. Yeah. No processing.
There's a, what is that about?
Well, it's interesting. Like, I try to sort this out with different kinds of relationships because certain relationships, I have a much, I kind of operate in a much more mature way. Mm-hmm. And then other relationships, I operate in a much more immature way. And the most immature way is often with my wife.
Yeah.
You know, at work, I can be really patient and forbearing and very thoughtful. But a lot of times with my wife, it will, what you said in terms of it kind of building up. And so many times in our marriage, she say, "What's going on, Greg? What's going on? What's wrong? What's going on?" And sometimes when she puts that to me, I actually just like I don't.
Can you describe that facial? Yeah.
I'm like trying to speak, but I can't speak. And I mean, I do a ton of journaling, so like I. But many times the explanation has gone like, well, it was like this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened. And that's why I feel so depressed and despondent and angry. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just one thing. It was this built up thing.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me why certain relationships, it's really an immature expression where other ones I can actually articulate it easier. And I think like at work and stuff, I do it much better. But like I have like Superman with kryptonite when I go home, you know,
I completely relate to that. Yeah. And for me, it feels like, cause I was thinking about this when I was going through your questions and it kind of relates to the next one. Am I allowed to jump?
Yeah, please. This is
so being misunderstood.
Great transition, yeah.
I feel like there's misunderstandings that hurt my feelings, but that's not the one I'm thinking about. I feel like I'm misunderstood a lot of times. It feels like the relationships I care less about. So, like, my work colleagues, I care about them. But it's not, like, my marriage. It's not, like, my motherhood of my son. Those are the ones where I care the most. And for whatever reason, those are the ones where I behave the worst. Mm. And I think it maybe is because I won't say the little things that bother me because I'm trying to be this best person.
Okay.
Whereas at work, like if somebody does something, I can just be, I for whatever reason, am able to say it, and I say it in a more calm way. It sounds like you do the same thing, and I just deal with it when it happens, because I guess it's more business, and it's less like I don't really know why.
Because you know what you need to do,
but
you're there to do a job.
Yeah.
But there's more, it sounds like there's more pressure for you
exactly.
around being good. When it comes to motherhood.
Yeah.
And
it's the same thing with my parents. Like, my relationship with my parents is the same way. I will bottle and then explode. It's the people closest to me.
Mm.
And I don't know if it's that I only let the pressure build or I don't even think I let it build in the other relationships. I don't think I care enough for the things even to bother me, maybe.
And maybe it's because it's the closeness.
Yeah.
Because at work, it's the same thing. Like, I have this one officer that just gets under my skin, and I just pretty much tell him how it is. Like, you don't like it, tough crap. You know, you have a job to do, and I'm sending you to that job. Just do it. Where, like, with my mother, she might say or do something that just annoys the heck out of me, and I'll just bury it until, as you said, you explode.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know.
Do you find that the people you work with or the people in those other relationships think of you as somebody who just lets things roll off their back?
Yeah.
You're like really easygoing, totally calm.
Well, sometimes not that I say I don't like care about my work colleagues, but I'm not really bothered if I hurt their feelings as much, you know, like because I'm not as close to them. Sometimes I feel like that.
Yeah.
If something happens and there's a conflict, I'll be like, well, hey, look, you got to fix this. You know, like I don't know how else to put it. And I'm not as bothered by that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when I go home or like my parents or my brother or my husband, it's almost one of those things like they're doing something that annoys me or frustrates me, but I'm trying to like give them grace and be like, no, just let it go. But, you know, it's you're not letting it go. And sometimes you're around them more and mm-hmm. it's just like constant.
Is there more pressure to get it right because the stakes are higher?
I think so. Yeah. Like I'm not bothered so much if I don't have a great relationship with a coworker of mine, but it very much bothers me if my relationship's not right with Randy. And I'm like, we need to make this right. And so sometimes there's that pressure to let things go, but we're not letting them go.
What we know about type ones, at least this seems to be pretty widespread across most ones, is that in places and contexts where you're more relaxed, like vacation, and some ones for them, it's actually more stressful. But for a number of them, they'll say when it's on vacation or when I was in an exchange program and I was in France or when I was... It's when I felt like something shifted and I wasn't hearing the inner critic quite as much. I was more relaxed. I was functioning out of where my resource point, and for one of your resource points is the 7. And they said I really felt dialed down, like relaxed, and I went with the flow. It wasn't as stressful for me. But when you're in your normal work life, then it really gets much stronger. So I wonder if there's a corollary to that, where the closer you are to where the stakes matter, where things really are important, where you do want to perform well, that's where there's more of the expression of that perfectionism from the one. And it shows up both self-critical, but also at times critical of those around you, as part of, well, it comes from not only your own sense of needing to be better and wanting to be better, but also wanting to improve those around you as well. Like it's where you really lean in to try to improve things.
See if anybody agrees with me, but I think for me, there might be something where in these close relationships with my parents, my son, my sister, my husband, I sort of have an expectation that we should have the same values. We should want it to be the same way. And so, like at work, I can totally understand that my patients might have different values than I am and make different choices about their health. If I were on an exchange program, I'm in a different country, I'm learning a new way of doing things. That's the whole point, is that I'm appreciating the differences. But like with the relationships that are closest to me, I have an expectation that my husband will do whatever the way I will, come home on time or whatever. And so when they don't happen, it bothers me. But then I try to do the other thing and be like, well, you know, he didn't mean it, this, that, and the other. But it adds up because it actually does bother me in that context, because I actually do expect to the right and the wrong exist in that space in a way that they don't exist maybe in the other spaces.
So you try to let it go, but it just ends
up. Yeah. So maybe I'm not applying.
It's interesting. I was tracking with you when you were saying that, because that was what was coming to mind. It's like you're very black and white at home, but then elsewhere you're like gray. You know, like there's. So is that? I mean, do you guys, the other ones, you feel like, or do you feel like the black and white is everywhere I go?
I don't have that option at work.
Yeah,
we have protocols that we have to follow.
It's pretty black and
white.
It's
pretty much black and white. Yeah. You know, every situation is different, but you know the protocol is going to be the same for.
Yeah.
So.
I think where the stake – I think what I resonated with you, Joel, is like when you said it, where the stakes are high. So I would say like – again, there's like a lot of idealism like regarding marriage. You know, there's a teacher that I really like, I listen to, and he talks about, you know, your marriage is supposed to be like a sign and wonder in the world. People should be able to look at your marriage and like it should point them to – that's a high.
Wow.
That's a high, high calling. That's like
mine is a sign and wonder at times in a different way.
I feel like some people would hear that and be like, oh, that's nice. But I think we hear that and we're like, I have to make that happen.
Yes.
You're right about that. Yeah. A lot of others would not hear it that way, but that's a very good point. You're right. So you're pointing to what Greg is saying. It's like you really feel the weight of that.
Yeah. So I think, again, so the thing of like being connected to my spouse is really important to me, because because I love it and I want to be connected, but it's also a thing like I want a relationship to be like that. And I do embrace the notion of that our marriages should be a sign, that there should be something about them that is pointing and appealing. And then when I think of like work, the stuff that I'm really vested in, I mean, the stuff that I'm working in is I've taken on a lot of projects where you try to do something that hasn't been done quite that way before. And the reason it hasn't been done that way before, because it's really hard to do it that way, because so there's a lot of reformation kind of work that I do. And so that's like stuff that I really care about. Mm. Because you're trying to create something new that hasn't been done, you're always falling short of it. Mm. And then navigating that with your team is, you know, something that we have to constantly kind of do too. Mm. And just, I don't know.
I think I'm a very black and white person, like see things one way or the other. And I mean, looking up, my parents told me that growing up, like ever since I was a little kid, like, Stephanie, there's no gray with Stephanie. There's no gray. But I feel like in healthcare, it's like a world of gray. And so sometimes I kind of have to.
In what way?
In the sense, just give an example. So I'm a physical therapist. I deal mainly with inpatient rehabilitation. So My patients usually don't come in walking and talking and things like that. So if a patient has a stroke, I can read what kind of stroke they had, what their functionality is right now, and I can see step 1, 2, 3 all the way to 30 or whatever to what they need to do to be independent again and get home. Like, it's very black and white to me. I'm like, A plus B equals C, man. Like, here's what we got to do. But that does not take into account patient's living situation, motivation, their understanding, their education, their health literacy, you know, their family, how much support they're going to have. I mean, there's so many factors that make it to you're like, well, this is not, in general, this is not black and white. And so sometimes I think it's more, not that I have any gray in me, because I really don't, but I have to adapt to that. Hmm. And I usually try to make the darker grays all the way black and the lighter grays all the way white and kind of make it a pretty little picture here. And
that's a great way of looking. I love that. I love that. So how do others, I mean, you started a little bit down the track of what others might find confusing about you. What are some of the things that people might find confusing?
I pick things apart. I have to dissect them. Like, I have to know as much as I can about either the topic or the situation.
And what makes that, what do you think people are confused by?
Because some people, I was like, oh, yeah, as she said, A plus B equals C. Well, I need to know exactly how A plus B equals C. I need to know how you got to that option or, you know, stuff like that.
So you need more details.
More details. You I'm wicked details.
More, like, data.
More data. Research is like the biggest thing for me.
Okay.
Like, yeah. I can't even tell you how many hours I've spent researching.
Is that why you originally thought you were a 5?
I thought it originally was a 5 because that's what the test originally told me. Mm. Oh, okay.
So. The research thing.
Yeah. And, like, attention to detail. Like, if I'm doing a project and I'll look at it, like, someone might think it's perfect, but I'll find that one little flaw and, like, I'll have to redo it.
Do people get confused by the level of attention that you give to detail or your need to want to know more? Like, I need more information. Do they get confused by that and suspect something? Do you feel like at times people suspect something, like, you know, you're not trusting?
Well, I have a hard time trusting anyways.
So that's real.
Yeah.
no suspecting.
There's no suspecting there. Yeah. Okay. Anybody that knows me knows it takes me a while to trust.
Okay.
But yeah, absolutely. There's always, why do you need to know more? Because mm-hmm. I need to know more, mm-hmm. you know, mm. you know, until I feel I'm comfortable enough with it.
Mm. I think we were saying something about this earlier about intentions and not always being able to verbalize intentions. Yeah. And I think what can be confusing about me is I don't always know how to verbalize why I'm doing something or what I feel like I need to be doing, but I just know, like, this is right. Like, this is right. This is the end goal is good. And that can be really confusing because that tends to lead to a lot of miscommunications. And it just takes me, because I'm a slow processor, it just takes me a while to feel put together what I'm thinking of what I want to do and to actually verbalize it and say it, which it's obviously very confusing for other people who aren't inside my head. So, yeah.
Sometimes it's easier just to do it.
Yeah, just do it and then explain later.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And you're describing the body type really well, which is that your intuition functions more at that level, at the body level, which is you have an internal knower that knows what to do. And so then you have to come up with sometimes a justification for it or an explanation for it. And that takes a little while sometimes to come up with that. But there's a sense of like, but trust me, I know, right? There's like this sense of I know what I'm doing. I know this is going to work out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the misunderstanding, maybe the pausing and thinking. When I was a pastor, my wife, when we were in a small group with leaders or something, and the question was being asked, and maybe it was kind of tense or whatever, there was a tense issue we were trying to really sort out or whatever, she'd say, Greg, like, you need to say something. Like, she is saying, like, people can misinterpret your silence and not understand what you're thinking. You're thinking about it, but they don't know what you're thinking. You know what you're thinking, and so they can misread you. Mm. So that's something that's been pointed out. I think another thing people are confused about, because I am a kind of an idealist and reaching. I do tend to do things well, and people often say, you know, that project went really well or whatever. But what they don't know is that inside of me, there's all this really self-talk and a lot of self-doubt. And I feel like I run on a low-grade anxiety fever. Yeah. I mean, anxiety is like an issue for me, but I can perform really well and people will see that, but they don't know that I have an anxiety fever going on inside of me. Yeah. And I feel like I kind of run on that low-grade fever all the time.
But at the same time, doesn't it drive you?
It can. Yeah. Yeah.
The misunderstanding is what the world sees me doing and what's happening inside, like you were saying, are often very different. And I don't even know what I look like from the outside because I might feel very anxious or I might feel very angry. And I think, why don't they know? Why are they, you know? But from the outside, like the feedback I get at work is that like nothing phases me. I'm so mellow. I'm great under pressure. I'm great in moments of crisis. But it does not always feel that way inside. I feel like I'm timid and I'm sort of scared and I don't know if I know what I know. And being quiet a lot of times definitely happens. And I think the people who haven't worked with me as long think that, you know, I must be new and I'm kind of unsure. And like, that's not what's happening. It's just I don't always verbalize it.
You're processing it.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing that I think might be helpful for people listening who have adolescents or young adults as their children or loved ones. When you were talking, I was thinking about when I was discerning my career and my parents. Growing up, it was all, Amanda, don't rip up your homework. It's fine. It's fine. Just go to bed, like you were saying, wanting things to be perfect because I would have to start over. But then when I was like post-college, I had graduated with a degree in religion and international relations. But all of a sudden, I knew in my gut that I was supposed to be in healthcare taking care of women. I had not taken science courses in college. And to my parents, this was like, it looked like on the outside to them, I had no direction. I was just flitting around. And what happened was I didn't know that midwifery existed as a career. I didn't know what that was. So it took me a number of years of what looked to them, whatever their personality type is, that I couldn't make a decision. That like it was processing, like you were saying, Greg. I was processing for a number of years, but it looked like I just couldn't make a decision. I was just changing my mind all the time. And to them, that was very disconcerting because they just want their child to be stable and figure it out and have a job. Mm. And now that I've figured it out, it's like what was in my gut, as soon as I heard the thing that existed that I didn't know existed, it was like, oh, there it is.
Mm.
And I haven't turned back and I'm pleased with it all. But there's, I think, that misunderstanding that on the outside, it looks like I'm doing something different than I'm actually doing. And I guess I'm not a good enough communicator to explain that. So people are assuming things about me, which is very frustrating. I'm sure the rest of you feel very frustrated. Yeah.
Well, that seems like all of you, all four of you have that, where the internal does not match the external, at least the way the world is reading it around you. Yeah. What about feedback? Is there any confusion around that? I've heard some ones describe it as, you know, I give feedback or, you know, and to my utter surprise, people don't respond to feedback very well. And it was meant as a,
you know, to actually help them improve.
I had some self-awareness learning to do when I first entered the healthcare world, but I did, in my mind, when I have a patient that wants to get better and appears motivated, I'm like, okay, well, I can tell you exactly what you need to do to get motivated. And I just, in my mind, it came out very encouraging and motivating, like, yes, let's do this. And then there was a couple instances where either my friend or my husband and I worked at the same hospital and they had like the same patient. And they're like, Stephanie, what did you do to that guy? And I was like, well, I thought we had a good talk. He was like, man, he is scared. Like, I don't, can we, cause like he's scared shitless, you know, like, we can't, like and what I was trying to say, like, yes, like, look, if you work with me doing X, Y, and Z, you will be up and getting walking again. But what they heard and what I actually said is like, well, if you want to walk again, you will do this or else we're not going anywhere. And, you know, I just didn't, there's that lack of awareness. And I, you know, I guess because I like to be told like what I need to do. You know, I like clear direction, but that doesn't always get accepted well. Some people need softer feedback.
I definitely have a streak of being like a soapbox speaker, like getting up and, I mean, I think I do it less now, I hope. But like as a teenager and in college, like my poor parents and my poor boyfriend, like, you know, criticizing what they're eating, what their political views are, because I clearly know how everything should happen in the world. So, yeah, I think that's sort of what you're saying, right? Like trying to give feedback, but people wouldn't suddenly change the way they vote or, you know, put down their fork or whatever. My poor boyfriend, I was vegan in college and he was like making macaroni and cheese his mom had sent him. I can imagine this moment where he's like, go ahead and tell me about the cows. But, you know.
Yeah, I think as a reformer type, you know, giving feedback for what could be better. I mean, that's kind of, and again, to me, this is all contextual. Depends on what context you're in. I mean, I'm really grateful that I like have an awesome workplace, and it's like it's a learning organization that has a really high value and tolerance on feedback and reflection learning, and so I feel no squeamish because it's not based on hierarchy or anything like that. Like a lot of organizations are really hierarchical and you got to know your place and you waste a lot of energy thinking about that. No, our organization is very, I personally feel, maybe not everybody in an organization feels this way, but that I'm very free to give feedback and it's really well received. But in other contexts, again, going back to like my wife or my home. So, you know, my dad was kind of a passive person. He was just kind of passive. I mean, he wasn't abusive or anything, but he was pretty passive. And so my default is passivity in my fathering that I've had to push against to be more present and to be give input, feedback to my kids or whatever. And then with my wife, that's been the most difficult relationship of giving, communicating in a mature way, including giving feedback. So while I can do it really well at work, I don't always do it really well with her.
Mm. Yeah, really good. Thank you. This is excellent. I think it's helpful to our, you know, to me and to our audience, like people listening in, trying to understand ones. What's going on with a one? What's really happening inside? Because sometimes we don't know. We're talking to a one, and it seems like, you know, when they give feedback, you know, and tell me that this is the better way to do something, it can feel like a shameful thing, like there's something wrong or unlikable about me, when really what you're communicating is, I love you so much, I want to help you. Right? And so in between there, of course, and this is not what this podcast is about, we're going to be talking at a different time about some ways forward between relationships, which is really helpful to just understand what's happening there.
Something, it kind of goes back to what you were saying when you were talking about with your patients and, you know, like their health literacy and all these things that affect their ability to follow your instructions. So it gets gray. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking that the feedback that I would give more harshly to the people I love, like you said, Greg, would be, like, I might be more harsh with that because I think I know what's going on for them in the background. Like, I, with my patients and other people, I might be able to assume, you know, somebody cuts me off on the road, I can make up a story in my head about why, you know, he's rushing to the hospital because his mother is in surgery, whatever. Like, I can make some reason up why they might do the thing that's wrong. And so I can accept that there may be gray in those scenarios with strangers or with people I don't know as well. But with people I think I know very well, I make the assumption that I know what's going on for them. So I know the right way they should be doing it. And so I either give the too direct feedback that's not turns out not to get received well, or I get angry and like it can go both those directions. Or I give the feedback, they don't do it, and then I get angrier. And so maybe that's misunderstanding, you know, the people around you. Because as we have just said, there's a lot going on below the surface that people aren't seeing in us, but that we're also not seeing in other people.
Exactly.
And I think probably more so in the people we love more so much that we don't, we assume we already know it all, but we definitely don't.
That's a great way of looking at it.
Yeah. I think
that's a great way of looking at it. And there are different ways that each type can figure out, like, oh, this is what I need. I wonder if I express that too to other people and to be able to see like, oh yeah, people don't see me quite the way I really am. Maybe I don't see quite the way they are either. And that's a really mature thing for type ones to move into is that ability of maybe there's some things I don't know. My body tells me I know. This is an internal knower.
Yeah.
You know? And that gets you back into action and back into making the world a better place. You need to be always moving towards perfecting. And so that little pause of maybe is a healthy step. So really good.
I'm really curious how this group receives feedback. Like I would be interested in kind of.
That was another question I had in my mind. I wasn't sure whether to ask that. But this is, yeah, sure.
How we receive feedback.
Not well at all.
I think I have a really hard time receiving feedback because if there's a mistake that I made or something that I need to do better, it's very rare that whoever's coming at me telling me that has caught me by surprise. I've already probably thought it 100 times in my head. Oh my gosh, I cannot believe I made this mistake. The inner critic. Yeah, that's like dessert for the inner critic, right? Like, oh yeah, you made this mistake. Here we go. Or you need to do something better. So I tend to be a little more sensitive. I think in a lot of areas of my life, I'm not a super sensitive person. But when it comes to criticism or feedback, it's usually because I've already beat myself down so much.
Okay.
So.
Really good. Yeah.
I have to agree with that because by the time that person tells me you did it wrong, I've already found out 5 different ways how I could have fixed it or done it right, you know, or I should have said this versus this.
Yeah, you already have the inner critic. Now you have an outer critic.
Exactly.
It's you know, it's already hard enough with that. Yeah.
Yeah, generally it just tends to, like, external critic just amplifies the inner voice that's already there. It just makes it louder, screaming at me, you know. And depending on what kind of disposition, I mean, if I can step back and reflect and kind of take it, I mean, there is a way to maturely process it. And certain relationships, it is easier to maturely process the feedback. It always stings to a certain degree. But if you're in a vulnerable state, particularly, like if you're fatigued, you're tired, you're stressed out, and then somebody delivers some feedback, or formal feedback is more important, is harder for me than even informal. So when you're going to sit down and you did a project or a presentation and they're evaluating you, and it's in a formal way. I'm always a little, like, kind of on edge because.
I definitely think it depends on who's giving the feedback and how they're giving it.
Yeah.
Like you said, you know.
If you want to give me feedback that's important to you, you should wait until I am well rested. I am in a good mood. Whatever, if it's related to a conflict or something that really I know didn't go well, wait till I've had plenty of time to process that and come to my own settled peace about the whole thing. Because I think I can definitely receive feedback, like from my husband. Like, I'm trying to love him better. So I can receive it, but not in the middle of a disagreement and not when I just got home from work and I'm tired. It has to be like in the right context. Mm. And I have to agree with what you're telling me. Because there are also times where I receive feedback and I'm like, you're just wrong.
Yeah.
And that is what it is.
I like that.
Yeah. So the inner critic has already told you what's wrong. And hearing feedback is almost like the inner critic is justified. Like, see, if you had only whatever, dot, 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 you only had worked harder. If only you had done it this way and not that way. If only. Does that happen internally for you? Or does the external critic, the external feedback, are there times where the external feedback does not confirm what your inner critic has already been criticizing you about?
Very rarely. But for me, it's like when I get that external feedback that just confirms in how I feel, it's like it's in a microphone, like screaming at me. Mm-hmm.
So even if someone's not screaming at you?
Even if we're just talking like now, it's like they're on a PA system yelling at me.
Feels that way.
Yeah.
Mm. It can almost like make me a little bit nauseous sometimes because like, you know, you get this inner critic criticism feedback, but you know, you try to fight and be like, no, that's not who I am. That's not like, I'm not that bad of a person. And then someone comes and like confirms what they were saying and you're like, yeah, I guess I am really just a terrible person right now. So it's like a punch in the gut. Mm. Yeah.
It's a mixture because again, like the organization I'm a part of, feedback is a really important value. So in a sense, it's kind of normalized and I know that. And so there are certain times where I can enter into the feedback and it's just in a mature way. But then there are other times where I'm just in a vulnerable position and when it's evaluating me. And I don't know about you guys. I mean, sometimes really, I've told you, like really scary, like this other person is, you know, like talking to myself about I'm playing back, you know, what the person said or that scenario and how like yucky I felt. And I find myself even saying it out loud, like I'm in the bathroom and I'm playing this thing in my head and it comes out and like, man, if somebody was watching or taping you, they think you are
like a crazy or something.
Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. I mean, it literally comes out and sometimes in really vile ways, like you stupid, like, you know, I say that out loud. Mm. You are so stupid. So I'm kind of wanting to little to know that I'm not the only crazy one. No, like no. If the other one. No. Like,
not at all.
Seems like you're in a group of others who understand.
Yeah. It's probably some of the darkest moments I've had in my life are like times when something that was very important to me, I didn't do very well, and I know it, and I feel bad about it, and then somebody else pointed it out. And, like, that night lying in bed, I'm like, a few times in my life, not, like, truly suicidal, but, like, I shouldn't even be here. Like, I am a mistake. I am not good to anybody. And it's when those things align, and it's something that was important to me, the inner critic can be, if I'm not saying it out loud, I might as well be. Like, it's right that it is everywhere, and it takes over everything. Mm. Like, it overshadows any positive thing I've ever done, any positive anything. Like, it can be very overwhelming in those moments. Mm. Mm-hmm. The only times when I can think of when the outer feedback wouldn't match and, like, wouldn't bother me are, like, things that wouldn't matter to me. Like somebody comes over to my house and says, you know, you really should alphabetize the books in your bookcase or something. Like that kind of feedback, I think, would roll off me as much as it would anybody else.
See, to me, that's just their own opinion.
Yeah.
You know,
you're just wrong.
It's, yeah, yeah, exactly.
It goes back to you're just wrong, right? Because again, everything comes back to that. There's a real reliance on that knower inside of you, the right and wrong.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't fit into that, it falls off of you. Yeah. Let's talk about how people get to know you, type ones.
Just spending time. You know, just be understanding and spend time and kind of learn our quirks.
So one of the things we were noticing as we went through these podcasts is how many people would say something similar. Like time or quality time, but mean radically different things by them. So what does that time look like?
It could be anything from, hanging out, having phone conversations or even conversations and just really getting to know the person,
I think sometimes having an understanding, I know you mentioned the word slow, like just when someone's trying to get to know me, just understand that, I'm not going to initially just be like, yes, let's be best friends. It's going to take time to build that trust, but it means a lot to me if you put that time in. And I very much like being asked a lot of questions. It doesn't bother me, and I like to ask questions back to people. I feel like that's a good way to like find where certain people tick. Like, you hit something that I'm passionate about. Like, yes, let me tell you about this. And to truly listen to what my opinions are about something that I'm passionate about is a big thing.
That's exactly where I was trying to go.
So you're listening to your opinions. Listening to your thoughts, listening to your opinions, being asking you questions.
I agree with the asking. I don't know if this is my oneness, so you guys can decide. But being asked, I think, makes a huge difference because I feel totally comfortable being an open book about really anything. But there's something inside me that doesn't want to impose myself on other people. Mm-hmm. So, like, if I'm sitting here and you ask me a question, but you don't really listen to the answer, and then you just want to talk about yourself, I'm happy to sit there for 2 hours and listen to you talk about yourself, and I'll keep asking follow-up questions, and I won't mention a thing about myself. And I'm not sure what that is, but I'm getting some nods, so maybe that's part of being a one.
You're happy?
Well, okay. Good point.
For 2 hours listening? I don't know.
I'll do it.
Yeah.
I'll be disappointed that you didn't get to know me. I'll be disappointed that you didn't care, or I'll think that you didn't care. But I also will kind of I'll write you off a little bit. It's like, and you're not somebody who's going to get to know me, and that's okay. Yeah. Like, I guess there's a part of me, like you're saying, is it really okay? There's some offense, I guess, taken when that happens. But, like, I would leave that party being like, we're not going back there. But I wouldn't be angry about it. I would just be like, they're in the group of people who I don't have to put energy into almost. I don't know.
Yeah. So it's interesting because I have some relationships with people who they're not very self-aware. At least I don't perceive they're self-aware that they take up all the oxygen in the room. Mm-hmm. And they will talk about themselves and talk about themselves and talk about themselves. And they don't have any curiosity about you. And so my best relationships are ones that are reciprocally curious of one another. Okay. So I will feel satisfied with a conversation relationship where I ask you good questions, I listen to you well, and you listen well to me, and you ask me good questions, and we've had this really deep, meaningful connection and exchange. That's, like, really good. Mm-hmm. So the people that I know don't do that, like, I can take a certain dosage of them. And I almost had to gear myself up and kind of say, okay, I'm going to go for 2 hours and she and he are going to talk and they're just going to talk and maybe at the very end they may ask me a question, but by then it's so spent. I don't really trust that they're going to listen to my answer anyway. So I just, it's just a category of relationship, yeah, as you say.
You just gave me clarity the way you said that because I've always thought like, I'm just an introvert, but it makes a huge difference what the quality of the interaction is. If I'm with somebody who's really listening to me and like there's, not that many people in my life who I'm like got on that level with, a couple dozen maybe, like if I take my family and friends. But like those interactions are never draining. Mm-hmm. But I do feel, I think, more drained than other people do when the opposite is happening, when it's like I just go and it's a room full of people and nobody's really listening to me and yeah, it's interesting.
Hmm. Do you think all ones are introverts?
According to what we know, I mean, just based on years of Enneagram being around and people reporting themselves as type ones, is that there's a mixture, extroverts, introverts.
But even that language is a little difficult sometimes in terms of understanding what that really means. So people that generally what we say is people that get drained by being around people. Well, that's too exhausting for them. Those would be more considered introverts. People who find more energy being around people, we call those people extroverts. But what's fascinating about this is exactly what you're illustrating, Amanda, is that there are people who have always thought of themselves as being extroverted or introverted. And then when they do a little self-reflection, a little bit of work on their type, that they discover something they didn't know was true. That it illustrates it really well. Like people that won't ask you questions. But then when someone does, then suddenly there's energy there. And it's really wonderful. And you can go 2-3 hours in a conversation with somebody like that. And so then it confuses it. Well, am I an extrovert or an introvert? Because that was a real wonderful external processing thing we just did, and I found energy from it. Right. So yeah, so that's the best I can say about.
Could you be a little bit of both?
Sure. According to the best science out there is that we are generally prefer one over the other, but some of us are closer to the middle where there's a more of a split, where there's, you know, maybe 60% extroverted and 40% introverted, or sometimes it's even closer than that for folks. Yeah. But I wouldn't stop there. And this is where what I would say to any listener is this is the unfortunate thing. And I think they're very helpful, the whole extroversion, introversion language, very helpful to people. But I wouldn't stop there because that only tells you a little bit about yourself. It doesn't get to the why underneath. What's happening underneath? What you just illustrated there by having this sort of insight, like, wait, you're right. When I'm with people who don't care to listen and I have to, you know, really draw on the energy to listen, that's exhausting. And then I do feel like I need to go recharge alone somewhere, right? So I think that's pressing a bit more deeply so that you can understand yourself better and then end up with a more realistic picture of, actually, I'm surprised that I'm not 20% extroverted. You know, I might be more like 30% or 40% extroverted. I'm still more introverted, but I can deal with people and I can enjoy people. I just now know that this is the thing that I need to do in relationship with people is recognize these people take a lot of energy. These people don't. And, you know, so, yeah.
How else do people get to know you?
Allowing for the slow processing, too, with like with harder questions or with more in-depth discussions, not being so pushy to be like, well, come on, what's your answer? What's your answer? Then you might not get like, okay, well, I can spit something out right now. That's probably not what I'm actually thinking. But just giving that space in that time and not being critical of that time it takes to process. So,
yeah, that's very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think just practically, you know, I mean, I love coffee shops. I love sitting down with people in coffee shops and having these kind of in-depth conversations. So for me, that's a context where I'm going deep with somebody and connecting. I love like nature. And so finding commonalities with people that have interests in hiking or doing things like that and just hanging out and doing. While I can be like really kind of despondent at times, I think I'm known as like a fun-loving person. Like when I'm in a group, I usually rise to the occasion generally and in kind of funny and quirky. And so people perceive me that way as well.
Mm. Yeah. So there's a measure of, let me just clarify this too, is that the issue of relationship cannot be just totally whimsical and spontaneous. There needs to be some kind of respect of your need for schedule, for expectations, to know what's coming around the corner, to what's, you know, to have some kind of order within, you know, the natural flow of relationship and natural interaction. That sounds like that would benefit you most if it was done that way, rather than sort of like out of the blue during the middle of your day while you're working, someone calling you and saying, hey, can we just talk and have a conversation right now? And that doesn't seem to work quite as well
for you. Is that, would that be true?
Yeah, 100%.
It's true. It's funny that you mentioned phone calls because being away from home, so far away from home, most of our friends are back in Texas. So our communication is like phone calls or FaceTime. And it is so funny. My husband, he can receive a call at any time of day from one of his friends. I mean, doesn't matter. And they can just talk for hours. And it's quite impressive to me. I don't even know how that happens. But but for with my friends, like, I have much fewer calls because I need that time. Like, if I know I'm going to be talking to someone that I haven't talked to in a while, or maybe requires extra energy or maybe doesn't, but just going to require energy because it's, you know, I'm working and I'm tired. I have to schedule that time and I have to not prepare for it, but just kind of mentally like, okay, like getting ready for some conversation. And it means a lot to me when my friends do that. They respect that time, that, you know, they know, my close friends know, like, hey, let me shoot Stephanie a text and see what a good time is, you know, to talk. And that really goes a long way. It's a little thing, but it goes a long way. So.
Mm. I have to agree with that. I hate when people just call you. And it's like, you don't answer, and they're like, well, why don't you want to talk? I said, I don't want to talk. Like, it's those people that said, you text, hey, you free to talk, or can you talk? You know, it's, they respect your boundaries, I guess you could say, more than that person that calls and just expects you to answer the phone.
Yeah. Or the expressions of spontaneity, like, even in that, it's like, let's decide that we're going to be spontaneous now. Then it's okay. It's like planned spontaneity.
Planned spontaneity.
We're going to have this time.
Love
then it's
it.
Okay because, oh, well, this is what we plan to do.
We're being spontaneous. Oh, that's awesome.
I like that.
So one final question. I think it's been something that's been helpful for a lot of other type ones is having others extend grace. That's a language that a lot of ones really, that appeals to them, is the extension of grace from other people to you, you know, in the area of whether it's feedback or space and time or understanding your boundaries, but extending that kind of love, that kind of grace, say, well, there's a lot of freedom here for you, you know, not a whole lot of, you know, moral expectations, right and wrong, being communicated at you, has been really powerful for a lot of ones to experience that, because it's very difficult for ones to show themselves grace. And yet that is part of the work, is to be able to do that, to lean more into that space. Talk to me about that. Is that true for you, for sitting here, is the need for grace from people that love you?
Pretty huge. One of the best things my husband can say to me, and he probably knows me best of any person and knows kind of the Enneagram and the struggle of the inner critic really well. And anytime I'm going through a hard time or really just beating myself down, he can go and just be like, Stephanie, that person that you're saying that you are, that's not who you are. You are loved. You have been redeemed, and there is grace for this moment that you're in, and it's huge. Mm-hmm. And it helps kind of bring me out of that pit and of those darker moments. So,
Wow, that is powerful. I feel that. I feel good. I'll take that from me too.
To receive grace in the form of being reminded in specific ways of the more positive things about myself, too. Because in those moments when the inner critic is overwhelming me, I don't believe any of that other stuff matters. Mm. And so if I got angry at my son and I'm beating myself up after he goes to bed about why was I so hard on him about the stupid Lego I stepped in or whatever it was, for me at that moment, I believe that he's going to grow up and not remember, you know, the other 7 hours we spent together that day doing positive things because of the one time I, like, whatever about the Lego. And to have my husband is often the one who's there in those moments, because it's like at the end of the day when I'm reflecting, to be there to say, you know, you're a good mom or you're a good worker if it's something that happened at work that I received negative feedback about. That kind of way to receive grace, I think, to for someone external to remind me of the positive things about myself that I may not believe in that moment. And I may not believe it when they say it, but I will hear it.
You still need to hear it.
Yeah.
You still need to hear it, even if you're deflecting it.
Yeah.
You still need to hear it. Yeah. Well, I just want to say, when it comes to stepping on a Lego, I think everything is allowable in that space.
Yeah, I think hearing words of grace from people that love you is important. And speaking grace over myself, embracing that myself, a few years ago, a verse that just kind of screamed out me from Scripture was when Jesus, after he was baptized, and it said there was a voice from heaven and said, "This is my Son, whom I love and whom I'm well pleased." And like, I thought about that, like, do I feel like that from God? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm his son, I mean, and he loves me. And the phrase that is the hardest for me to hear from God is, "I'm with whom I'm well pleased." Because I feel like I'm not, you know, I feel like I know all my shortcomings and all that, my darkest places. But the thing that helped me to kind of be able to embrace that more is like my relationship with my own kids. Hmm. Because if my kids just coming to me, even if my kids are really struggling or they were flubbing up or whatever, if they came to me to just share their heart with me, like, I would love that. Right? And it isn't so much about how they perform. It's the fact that they're my kids and they trust me enough to bring me what's going on inside of them. And I would be so pleased with that as their father. And so that helped me to say what God's looking for me from more is that I will bring to him what's going on inside of me and that he's pleased with that. So he's not scoring exactly how I do everything, but that I want.
It's a beautiful, Greg, that is beautiful. Yeah. Taking it out of that scoring system to a different one for type ones where it goes to grace. And that's a really vivid image of grace. That's awesome. Thank you.
Well, something specific I want to highlight in the grace was specific was it took it from action to identity. It spoke it as far as this is what you have met this checklist or you've done this. And what you seems like you're able to receive in that space is like, and what Stephanie said too, is like, no, this is who you are. That's the reminder in that space, that it's a bigger picture than this isolated action of one day or the tallying of the right and wrong, that it goes back to the core of who you are as a person.
And I wonder if that originates from that sense that many ones, and this is in the literature, is that there's something morally defective, morally wrong, oftentimes functioning at the core of who you are. And so there's a belief of that. And so to have it said to you, the reminder of what Jim just said, the identity, it's like, but that's not who you are, even though that's what is functioning underneath. And so you work really hard at going against that through the check mark, through the tallying of good and bad. And there's a different system altogether that's available to the ones, you know. And to be able to receive that from those who are around you who are extending grace. So, yeah. Well, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
I think the identity piece, like Jim's pointing out, is like that's definitely been something that's helped me. Like to navigate this, like being grounded in my identity of who I am. Like so much of my work is like really important to me, and I can ebb and flow in my emotions depending on how I feel I'm doing in my performance. You know, a lot of my work is navigating conflict and stuff like that. So another passage out of the Beatitudes is that when Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God, children of God." And so there's the two things, that there's the peacemaking is actually an activity, is something that you do. That's something I'm executing. But the identity is they should be called children of God, sons of God. And I think a lot, you know, I'm 50, I'll soon be 59. I think about, you know, as I age and as my peer group people are getting older and like more people that I know are dying. Like, there's going to come a day where I'm not going to be able to do. What's going to sustain me is like my relationship with God, you know, not out of what I can do, because we all get a place where we're diminished. We can't do much, and even our thinking becomes less capacity. And so I always try to remind myself that it's my being with God that's the most important thing. That is, you know. So anyway,
yeah.
A quote I ran into, I guess a few months ago now, that was really life giving for me, and I was like, oh, I think more people who have inner critics need to hear this. Is that your inner critic is not the Holy Spirit. And that, I think, for years of my life, I honestly believed my inner critic was the Holy Spirit. You know, like, which seems so simple and like, okay, of course, like, if you read the Bible, of course, that's like not. I think for years of my life, I really thought that was the Holy Spirit. Like, oh, you must be just driving me to do better or to be more perfect. But that was really life-giving, because that's not who he is, you know.
One of the most interesting things and helpful things for me, and I'm a 7, not a 1, but it still was incredibly powerful, was understanding that originally that accusation and that sense of the accusations we hear and we receive or we do to ourselves, the accusations we make of ourselves, is that the name Satan, the Satan, which is the proper way of actually saying, that's where the name Satan comes from, is the accuser. That's the definition. That's the actual, it was an adjective. It wasn't a proper noun. And so when people referred to it, it was because it was in the legal term. The way they envisioned things was very much like, we're always in a court case and there's a prosecutor, the Satan, and he comes and accuses us before God of being flawed, of being imperfect. And that's the original story. That's the oldest story in the Bible. It's just the story of Job. And that's where that whole thing emerged from. And so, you know, the whole language of Satan is remarkable, because if you could actually understand or believe that or see that, it's like the whole accusation thing is actually not only not the Holy Spirit, but it comes from a different source entirely, a different energy. And so to see that in a different way. Now, that's the low side, because there's a high side, of course, to the seeing things could be improved. And that's a wonderful gift. So don't want to diminish that at all, to say like you shouldn't have any of that. No, the whole improvement and the need to improve, if that's not present in our world, things don't move forward. We don't actually get to see the way things could be in one's brain that. And so that's to never be diminished. That's actually to be excelled in a greater way, just without the sabotaging effect of, you know, the low side. Well, thank you to each one of you. This has been remarkable. It's been very helpful. And thank you for opening up and sharing your lives with all of us. So couldn't have done a better job. Grace and peace to each of you. Those two words are really important to all of you. Grace and peace to each of you.
All right, I want to extend a special thank you to our panel of ones, all four of them, who were hugely helpful and, you know, willing to come in and talk and be vulnerable in this space. At the tail end of these episodes, we wanted to do a little bit of coaching tips around relationship. A coaching tip as far as if you're in relationship with a one, or coaching tips for people who are type ones. So what do you think we should hit? What's the first thing you want to do in these tips?
Yeah, from both perspectives, you know, one is if you're a one in relationship, or you are the person who is in relationship with the type one. I want to give some tips for both. First, for the type one, if you're a type one and you're in relationship with a partner you're living with, or you're spending a whole lot of time with, and you want to develop that, you want to get better at that, or it's at work, what you want to do is pay attention to. And again, we keep saying this about all types, is your body, right? But body awareness is critical for all types. For ones, what will happen is if there's any sort of resentment, if there's any sort of anger, there's any sort of criticism that's particularly acute for them, they deal with the inner critic. is it will come through, and it'll come through in relationship with other people. And so if they're feeling very critical of themselves or something bad happened at work, they'll come home and it'll be with them. You know, if they have a bad relationship or a bad argument with their partner and then they go to work, they'll carry it there. So there's this sort of edge that sometimes happens for type ones that they describe happening when they get into other spaces and other people pick up on it. And so it's important for you as a one to notice that. And then to allow yourself really to become angry about the right things, which is, this is what is the real issue. You know, I had this fight and I didn't express my anger, which is what ones do, is to sort of repress the anger with a person that they're in conflict with or the issue that arose and to vent it out in some other way.
Or to deny it.
Or to deny it altogether, yeah. Because emotions are part of what is denied for the type one, you know. Yeah. And so to be able to go ahead and do so, to express that, is a real challenge for them. But it's a step, you know, and you take small steps towards that, and that becomes healthier for the type one in relationship with people. It's becoming aware of that, becoming aware of your inner critic that is sometimes you feel might be beneficial if I maybe correct somebody or instruct them on what they should do. Even though your intention is good, is to be aware that that doesn't always come across to others as helpful. And that just awareness is helping you, will help you to discern, is this the right time to say something? Is this the right context?
There's a tip for type ones that, so we all gravitate towards feeding our type to a certain extent. We almost feeding our own brokenness or feeding our own patterns. So a lot of times I think ones gravitate towards people saying, well, this is how you can do it better all the time. And they actually might balk or push against the messaging that appeals to other types, which is you need a lot of self-acceptance. But for type ones to grow, they actually need to lean into some of that work. Mm. They need to lean into some of that, the messaging that says, start with self-acceptance. Mm-hmm. Start with saying, this anger that I'm feeling right now, A, I am feeling it, and B, that it is okay that I'm feeling it. Mm-hmm. That starting with that acceptance,
yeah,
and going, it is okay that I am feeling this, I'm acknowledging it, then you can actually move into what to do about it. But to deny and repress something like that and saying, well, that's just something that doesn't matter, to minimalize the things that you're feeling, to minimalize thoughts that are going through your head, is not a good starting place.
Yeah. For what I've been saying just in general for all relationships is that if you do your own work and the other person is doing their own work, right, and you're in a relationship with that individual, the relationship actually becomes better. Mm-hmm. Because when we're coming to the relationship hoping that the relationship provides something for us, like that's when we have problems, because we're putting so much weight on the relationship, the space between you and the other person to actually nurture you, feed you, give you what you're looking for, that it breaks under that pressure. And so it's really about becoming aware that you can get your needs met. There are things that you need to work on that are yours. And by doing so, then the relationship is better that way. This is particularly true for those of us who are very self-improvement oriented, which type ones are. But the kind of self-improvement is oftentimes about repressing or denying. Mm. Right? So it's the repressing of the emotions, because this is not right in this moment.
And if I didn't feel this, it would be better.
Correct.
Right.
And it never, ever works for them, because what happens is they find themselves so tight and tense, they carry it oftentimes in their neck and their jaw, and they're stiff. Their body becomes stiff because of the sort of control. Well, first of all, it still leaks out. It comes across in so many different ways that people pick up on all around them. And then finally they pop. And when they pop, then there's all kinds of shame around that, right? So it's grace. It's grace. Grace, grace all the time. Show yourself grace. Practice receiving grace. Practice mantras around grace. And the more you do that, the more you'll find yourself extending grace to the world around you. So words like different and beautiful are very important to type ones. Like, it's not all right and wrong, because there are other categories besides that. You know, not everything has to end up in that kind of, you know, right, wrong category. There are other ones that are like, you know, categories like beautiful, things that fall under that. That is important for them to look at, is to look for beauty in the world and to allow themselves to enjoy that beauty. So it's a savoring of that beauty, and then also looking for that which is different. Like, that's just simply in a category of different. Not to feel like your category of right and wrong is a bad thing. It's actually a really helpful thing, because it helps bring the gray into the black and white. Just don't rush that process. Allow different to stay around for a little while. Allow the unknown to stay around for a little while. Those things that don't quite fit into that, let them be for a while. And then eventually they will fall into more black and white sort of actionable steps for you as a type one.
Yeah, don't rush the process is a very key, I think, phrase for them, because, you know, there's this goal to get to the right space. And a lot of times the process isn't valued enough. And if the process isn't undervalued, then we probably won't come to the right space anyway. And we'll actually have to go back and redo some things. So what tip do you have for the type one in their relationships with other people?
So for the type one in relationship with other people is, again, to recognize your impatience will come up, because there's a need to get right into making things better, right? Things that are wrong, make them right. Things that are imperfect, make them perfect. There's that need to get there. That can't be fast enough for the type one, because you got to get to that place of making things perfect. But people don't move that quickly in terms of self-improvement, in terms of getting things right. And to have patience for all people you're in a relationship with is going to be very key and very important. That's the act of grace, right? So you're experiencing grace. If you start experiencing grace for yourself, then you're capable of showing that sort of, you know, patience to other people. You're always going to be valued for your ability to see right and wrong. I think that is what draws us to you ones. You ones are, it's a fantastic gift. It's a beautiful gift. It's a powerful gift. And we're drawn to that.
We're drawn to your clarity when so many
drawn to your clarity, absolutely.
Yeah.
We're drawn to a lot of things about you, but the clarity component is really a gift. It's remarkable that you can really get to that place of improving things, seeing how things can be fixed. It's not that you're just, you know, you spot the imperfect, but you actually know how to fix it. And that's a great gift that the rest of us need. But it's the patience in between, right? It's the grace in between that, the awareness that I might be driven by that compulsion to feed the inner critic, that compulsion to be good, the fear of what if I'm not good enough, you know, what if I'm not right? So I think it's important in your relationships with people, because then you start to extend grace, you extend a little bit more patience, and that improves things for you.
There's also certain types who have more of a tendency to try and make the world in their image, or try to make the world as they see it should be. Some people are more thermometers. They are gauging, they're taking in the environment and sort of giving a reading of it. And some are thermostats. We want to turn the temperature to a certain place and make it in our image. And sometimes that makes things better. It actually helps. It makes things safer. It brings clarity situations. But there's other times when that very tendency can make other people feel like less valued. They can feel a lot of different things. But for type ones, just tune into the awareness that there is a desire to make the world as you see it. And if you tune into that awareness, sometimes that is enough. Sometimes that's enough to tweak. Sometimes that's enough to just go, oh, I'm doing that thing, and I may need to step back and learn better to value process. One type one that I mentored for quite a while really felt like she gained the most in leaning into valuing process instead of arrival. And that was like a turning point for her.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's really good. I think in terms of people in relationship with type ones, I think you also have to show grace. So it's mm-hmm. Type ones need grace because they are so self-critical. If you're going to give any sort of negative feedback to a type one, know that they have probably already thought about that. You might be surprised by how many things they've already noticed that are imperfect. Yeah. Pay attention to that. Bring that to mind. As soon as you're, you know, thinking about, I need to confront, I need to say something to this individual, is, okay, probably they've already thought about it. So because they've already thought about it, how then am I going to communicate that? Communicate it with lots of grace. Not flattery. That you can leave out because ones don't particularly care for flattery. They care for specific feedback that's, if it's good feedback, it's going to be specific to the things that they've accomplished, the tasks that they've accomplished. So that's helpful to them. So you might have that included in whatever you're going to say in terms of the sort of negative feedback. Another thing that's important is being aware and communicating your own failures, but with grace. So your own ability to say, yeah, I screwed up in this way, you know, and then just grace to yourself is really helpful to ones because they live in this world of feeling very much like I have to get things right. So that pressure is so enormous that when they see other people showing themselves grace, it kind of helps them to de-escalate a little bit.
That's a huge thing, I think, especially for parents with a kid you might suspect of being a one, is to model grace for yourself. So because if you're really hard on yourself when you mess up, but you can extend that to yourself and they see that modeled, they'll probably adapt to that more as they grow.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think also communication with ones is you need to make sure that it is very practical and concrete. Anything that is in the abstract, if you're going to ask, if you're working with a one and you have to give a project to a one or you're asking a one to accomplish something, right? Be sure to make it very clear as to what it is that your goals are. And if you don't know that you're not being clear, ask. Mm. Is this clear to you? Have I made it practical and concrete enough? Mm. Because if you haven't, that will make the one feel very anxious. If it's too nebulous, too conceptual, it's not actionable. And for ones, they need to be in action. So if you make it clear, this is the goal, this is what we're trying to accomplish. If you don't even know, if you're stuck and you don't know the clarity yet, you don't know how it's going to be, then just say that. Just, hey, I haven't gotten to the point of where it's concrete enough. So I'd love your involvement in that. That makes it helpful. So again, it's a lot of it is about communication, making sure that your communication's clear. But then let them run. Don't micromanage ones. That is so disempowering to them. They're going to react to that.
And they're probably going to do better at it themselves than you are going to be able to do that to them.
Anyway. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's great. Well, thank you guys again so much for joining us. Like we said, we have a new website, theartofgrowth.org, where you can sign up for our email list and find out about an online class we'll be teaching later this year. You can also get in contact with Joel or I through email there. We also have an Instagram account, which I wasn't going to put a lot into, but we have someone who's a three in our lives who is joined to help the team and
fantastic.
With social media stuff because that's not exactly our strong suit, so which is a wonderful thing. So we do have an Instagram now. It's just Art of Growth. You'll see our logo there, which is the same as the podcast one, which has recently changed, if you haven't noticed. So thank you again, and please leave us a review on iTunes. It helps people find the show. We appreciate you. Thanks for joining us and have an amazing week.